Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to today's Bidder Information webcast. This webcast is related to the Summer 2024 Index REC RFP for the procurement of RECs from utility scale wind, utility scale solar, brownfield site photovoltaic projects, as well as hydropower projects. My name is Benjamin Chi. I'm with Near Economic Consulting, the procurement administrator on behalf of the Illinois Power Agency for this RFP. And joining me today and presenting is Mr. Anthony Starr from the Illinois Power Agency, as well as Ms. Katie Olandi from NERA. So a few housekeeping items before we start. On this cover slide, you'll see some of the logos at the bottom of this slide. And this, again, is for the procurement of RECs for the IPA's portfolio of these following utilities. You'll find at the bottom Ameren Illinois Company, or AIC for short, Commonwealth Edison Company, or ComEd, as well as Mid-American Energy Company, or MEC for short. We'll use these short names going forward. And these entities are also what we call companies collectively throughout this presentation and in the RFP documents themselves. The second housekeeping item here is that the presentation as well as the audio recording will be posted to the RFP website right after the conclusion of this webcast. The website URL is at the bottom here of this slide, ipa-energyrfp.com. You can ask your questions at any point in time during the presentation. If there's something that is unclear, simply locate the chat icon at the bottom of your screen. You can type in your question there and hit send so that we can review and provide you a response throughout this presentation. But we'll certainly pause at the end of the conclusion of this webinar to address all outstanding questions. I'll start our webcast here with one disclaimer. So the entire RFP process is pursuant to the Illinois Power Agency Act, which give rise to the procurements, the IPA's long-term renewable procurement plan, which was filed, and the ICC order, which approved the plan, as well as the RFP rules and appendices. So you'll find these documents here. They include the IPA Agency Act, in particular, Section 1-75C of the IPA Act, which we'll have the RPS for these index REC procurements, Section 15-111.5 of the Public Utilities Act will be provided as well on our website. You can find those on the IPA's website as well. The long-term plan and the ICC order. ICC order is in docket 230714. And the final RFP rules and the index REC contract were posted on May 1st. So the disclaimer is this: any statements that we make in this presentation that describe or refer to the governing documents, including the RFP and the contract, they are summaries only. They are qualified in their entirety by reference to these documents. US, the bidders and the renewable suppliers will bear the full responsibility for reviewing and understanding these documents. So here is a snapshot of the RFP website. Again, posting of the documents occurred yesterday. That includes the final RFP as well as the final contracts. A red line of the documents, the prior versions, were also posted for your convenience. The easiest way to get to the documents is really on the IPA's Energy RFP website, the procurement website. Look at the left navigation bar. Locate the link that says Index Wind, Solar, Brownfield, and Hydropower. Click on that. Sublinks will show up. Go to Final Documents, and you'll find the documents that were posted yesterday. So that you can plan your time with us today, we have a total of about 70 slides to go over in this webcast. And in terms of the flow, we will start with a regulatory update and background for context that will be provided by the agency. And then We will walk you through, provide you an overview of the procurement event, what the steps are, what the requirements are at a high level, before we walk you through the terms of the transaction by a description of the supplier contract terms. Then we will shift gears to be more specific about the RFP process requirements and timeline. And we will close this session with what bids are, how you will think about the bids, as well as the contract execution post-bid process. So, without further ado, let me turn the time over to Mr. Anthony Starr of the Illinois Power Agency. Mr. Starr?
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chi. So I'll be quick because there's a lot of substance about how this procurement is going to be conducted that we want to get into and that are very important for all of you who are planning to participate in the procurement to understand the details. But just as to a quick regulatory background, actually going back before the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act, the IPA has sort of oversight over the Illinois RPS and procurement and programs to help bring renewable energy credits under contract for the utilities to help meet the RPS. The Climate and Equitable Jobs Act in 2021, however, significantly changed how we procure RECs from utility scale projects and brownfield projects, in that we moved to an index REC model that we'll be discussing a little bit later. So while we had done procurements prior to CEJA, the big change in the sort of framework we're working under now started in 2021, and with a series of procurements in 2020, 2022, and 2023 under this new model. One thing that we'll be spending some time discussing now in this webcast, because it's a new provision, is something that came out of Public Act 103.0380, which modified our indexed REC procurement model to include certain hydropower projects as being eligible. So we now have the ability to procure RECs from hydropower through our competitive procurement, not just RECs from wind and solar. Another key reference point is our long-term renewable resources procurement plan. This is a plan the IPA puts together and updates every 2 years. The current plan was started last summer, a long process that ran through our posting of the final version of that plan on April 19th. That is based upon various decisions the Illinois Commerce Commission made in approving it. So that plan is now in effect for the next 2 years, and the framework of that plan is what will govern the competitive procurements we'll be conducting in both 2024 and 2025. Next slide. Oh, can we go back one? Great. A couple of things I just wanted to flag is that a key pillar of CEJA was the focus on equity that we want to have as part of the development of the clean energy economy for Illinois. So the minimum equity standard, which is the way in which this is manifested, is very important to the state and to the IPA and key for this procurement, in that this is a requirement for projects that are participating in this procurement that are selected to ensure that their workforce meets these standards. So we've built out over the last year or two quite a lot of information on our website about the minimum equity standard, how it works, what you will need to do for that. So while we'll only be touching on that lightly in this webcast, there's a lot of resources now available. One thing I also wanted to flag is the Energy Workforce Equity Portal. So that portal is a place where what are known as equity eligible persons can register on that website. And we also have maps to help determine whether or not someone is an equity eligible person. There's a complex definition in Illinois law for what a person is to be equity eligible. One of those criteria is living in what is known as an equity investment eligible community. And we have a map lookup tool on that website. And this is a way which you can check your workforce and see if they will help comply with the minimum equity standards. One thing I wanted to flag is we have actually just recently updated those maps earlier this week, in that one of the sources of data for the map of where these communities are is something called an R3 map. This is something that came out of the cannabis legalization in Illinois. It is one of the two maps that are used to determine this. That map through something called the R3 Commission was recently updated, and a significant impact is that the number of downstate communities that are now included on the equity investment eligible community map have expanded. So if you're looking at your workforce, considering where you will find workers, please take a look at that map if you've looked at it previously, because you'll see it is significantly different, and that will obviously create a different set of opportunities for interested parties in this procurement to think about how to meet the minimum equity standard. Those are a couple of key things that I wanted to highlight, and with that, I'll turn it back to Mr. Chi.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Starr. So before I provide an overview of the procurement event, while we were providing the references to the governing documents, I might have misspoke about one of the references to the Public Utilities Act. The relevant sections are probably found in 16-111.5 of the Public Utilities Act, as well as 1-75C of the IPA Act, which are relevant to this index right procurement. So for the overview of the process, here are just key highlights to keep in mind. First of all, take note, the bid date is on July 18. We are featuring a 20-year contracts for REC deliveries, and the targets we have also found in the long-term plan are as follows. We have a total of 2.7 million RECs to be delivered annually from utility scale wind as well as hydropower projects. We have 600,000, 66,666 RECs annually to be delivered from utility scale solar projects. And for brownfield site photovoltaic projects, we have 74,000 RECs carved out to be delivered annually. We are procuring RECs on an index REC settlement basis, which is essentially a contract for difference. And the RECs from your project, they must be from the projects that are qualified through the RFP and that have been awarded through this RFP as approved by the Commission. These projects, once they produce RECs, the RECs are going to be allocated to each of the three utilities, AIC, ComEd, and MEC. In your bid forms, you're going to ask for the following pieces of information. You're going to name a strike price, which is a bundled price for energy and RECs on a dollar per megawatt hour basis. You're going to name a full quantity. This is an annualized number. This is what you're committing to deliver on an annual basis through the 20-year term for each delivery year. And you will also name what we call a minimum quantity, an annual quantity. If we can award part of your quantity, but not fully. So if you accept a partial award, what that quantity would be. This is what we're after as the minimum quantity. You'll also be required to name one of two trading hubs for settlement purposes under the contract, either the PJM NI hub or the MISO Illinois hub. So, as I said earlier, we are asking for projects in four different categories: utility scale solar, utility scale wind, brownfield site photovoltaic projects, and a new category, which is hydropower projects. So we're going to spend a little bit of time just fleshing out these definitions and the nuance of the hydropower project requirements. By definition, a hydropower project will be a new hydropower project that includes any impoundment facilities, diversion facilities, pump storage facilities that use the flow of water to generate electricity or storage at an existing dam. There's a second type of hydro projects that are called a newly modernized or retooled hydropower project. And for this type of project, it's really a hydropower project on existing facility that involves construction, repair, maintenance, significant expansion of turbines, at the existing facility. So these are the definitions we have, and they must importantly be associated with an existing dam. They cannot be associated with any new construction of a dam or any new dams. And for modernized and retooled hydropower, these are projects that you must show as a result of these modernized and retooled activities. They result in an increase in the installed capacity of the existing hydro facility, and they must meet once these activities, these modernized and retooled activities have completed. They must meet what we call a hydropower refurbishment threshold, which is basically 30% increase in production above the status quo as a result of these modernized and retooled activities. And if a bid is selected and approved by the commission, all RECs from the hydropower facility upon completion of these modernized and retooled activities are then deemed eligible for Illinois RPS compliance. So again, here on this slide 12, here are just additional requirements for modernized and retooled hydropower projects. These requirements are developed really to align with the use of public funds for procurement of RECs and to be consistent with the spirit of Public Act 103.03.80, which gave rise to the inclusion of hydropower in the agency's competitive procurements. So again, here we are after RECs from entities that have made a material investment and effort to expand production of renewable energy in the state, not simply continuing the operation or general maintenance of existing facilities. So for the rest of the categories, I'll talk about size requirements, location requirements, and a few other items in the next couple of slides. So in terms of the size requirements, if you're a utility scale wind or solar project, your project must be greater than 5,000 kilowatts or 5 megawatts in AC rating. This is the nameplate capacity that we are after. For hydropower projects, whether it's new or a modernized or retooled, as well as any brownfield site photovoltaic projects, there are no minimum size requirements. In terms of location requirements, all projects except for brownfield to be located in Illinois as well as in a state that is adjacent to Illinois that meets the public interest criteria, or projects where the energy can be transmitted over a HVDC line that meets some of the criteria in the Illinois Power Agency Act. I have received many questions about whether projects in states that are adjacent to Illinois would qualify or not, and my strongest encouragement to you is simply not to second guess yourself, but simply to fill out a very simple spreadsheet that can be provided to you upon request, and then to submit that to the Illinois Power Agency for evaluation. It takes very little time for you to fill that out and a very quick turnaround for the agency to make that determination and provide you the assessment whether your project meets the public interest criteria or not. And whether it qualifies to be part of the procurement or not. For brownfield site photovoltaic projects, the project itself must be located in Illinois and must be entirely contained within the brownfield site itself. It may be co-located with a greenfield project, but it must be within the brownfield site as identified by you in the proposal. In terms of energization-related requirements, when must your project be operational? For new projects, we are after the date of first operation as recorded by PJM, EIS, GATS, or MRATS, and that date of first operation must be after June 1st, 2017. This is what we mean by new under the law. And for any hydro projects that are modernized or retooled, the date when the modernized or retooled activities are completed, what we call the hydropower refurbishment completion date, must be after June 1st, 2017. We're going to use these two short names throughout this presentation, DFO for the date of first operation and HRCD for the hydropower refurbishment completion date. And again, we're looking for new projects and newly modernized and retooled projects. So these projects must be completed after June 1st, 2017, or modernized and retooled after June 1st, 2017. The RECs that are delivered are the products that we are after. We're not after the energy or the capacity from your projects or even the installation themselves. We're just after the RECs. And the RECs that are delivered to us for settlement purposes must include all environmental attributes, must be from projects that are selected through the RFP. We do not allow for replacement RECs from other facilities. You must set up and register with GETS and MRETS a standing order for the automatic transfer of your RECs to the buyer's account during the term of the contract. They must be transferred in an unretired state, and the standing order will take care of all of that. And these RECs must allow the buyer, the utilities, to comply with the Illinois RPS. So there is a regulatorily continuing element to these transactions. The earliest vintage month that we are accepting is the month of August 2024. This is the earliest vintage. Certainly, if your projects have not reached commercial operation by then, it means that the earliest vintage month will be after August 2024. It could be after that. But if your projects are already operational today and meets the criteria of new June 1st, 2017, then this is sort of the earliest date where your 20-year clock will start, August 2024. In terms of the firm requirements under the contract, initial REC delivery deadline for the first REC to be delivered under the contracts of the utilities is May 1st, 2029, May 31st, 2029. If you cannot meet this date for the first REC delivery by providing increased collateral, you could extend it 2 additional years out, May 31st, 2031. This is a no questions asked extension. If you provide additional collateral, the new initial REC delivery deadline will be extended to May 31st, 2031. And then after this day, May 31st, 2031, if you still cannot get your project operational, further extensions could be granted for good cause by the IPA. These are described in the index REC contract. Again, in terms of this increased collateral requirement, once you have met the REC delivery obligations, the first REC delivered, the collateral requirement will come back down to the original collateral requirement, and we'll explain that later on in this webcast. There's going to be a two-part process for this RFP, and the big takeaway here is basically that the entire process really is done online. Part one proposal is mainly done online, except for the payment of what we call a bid participation fee to the IPA. And then the part two is mainly done online with the bid assurance collateral to support your bids to be sent to the companies separately. But besides that, here are the timeline and the online process. So the timeline for part one proposal is to be submitted no later than noon on June 3rd, which is a part one date. For part two proposal, it will be for qualified bidders to submit your part two proposal as well as bid assurance collateral no later than noon on July 9th. In terms of bid evaluation, here is a very high-level overview of how it will proceed. So first and foremost, just take note that we have a confidential benchmark that we really cannot say much about on this webcast. So we do appreciate if you have questions, but we really cannot say much about the benchmarks. These benchmarks are developed by the procurement administrator in consultation with the procurement monitor, and they are approved by the Illinois Commerce Commission for use. All bids must meet the confidential benchmark established for use in the procurements. So only bids that meet or beat the benchmarks will be considered. And then for all of the bids, we're going to rank them by their own category, and there are going to be some adjustments made for ranking purposes. So again, we're going to look and rank from lowest to highest the strike price of the bids, and the adjustments to the strike price will occur for these three different occasions when there are projects that commit to greater than the minimum equity standard. The minimum is 10%. Anything greater than that, there will be some price adjustments that will make your bids more favorable. And for utility scale wind or solar projects that are located within 50% of a at least 50% within an energy transition community grant area, ETCG area, they'll be granted some price adjustments. And if you're a hydropower project located in or adjacent to a hydropower preference community, these are all terms that you can find defined in the REC contract. You will also be afforded a price adjustment. And at that point, after the strike price have been readjusted, we will then look at the projects to fill the target based on a strike price basis, taking the lowest first until we hit the target. And there are going to be three targets that we are after to fill: one target for utility scale solar projects, one for brownfields site photovoltaic projects, and a combined target for all hydro and utility scale wind projects. There will be no post-bid negotiations, and target for a category may be exceeded when we select the marginal project, but in no case will we select projects out of price order. And for more information, we do refer you to the RFP rules that will really describe for you how evaluation will take place, including any tight bids and tie-breaking procedures. There will be two types of fees that are relevant to this procurement process. The first is a bid participation fee that will be required of all bidders, and this is the requirement is $500 per bidder. This is not per project. If you have a bidder with multiple projects, you pay this $500 once and once only for all procurement events that will occur this year, 2024. And then there's a second type of fees that you will have to pay, but this is incurred only for winning projects. And this is due to the IPA within 7 business days of the ICC approval of results. The estimate at this time is 60 cents per rec. This is 60 cents times the annual quantity of recs that you have been awarded. We will confirm this number, the supplier fees, no later than 2 business days prior to the bid date. Again, two types of fees. The first type of fee, bid participation fee, is due by the part one date required by all bidders. The second type of fees is the supplier fees, only for winning projects and winning bidders, due within 7 business days of the approval of results. So I'll move through quickly about the supplier agreement and the terms of these transactions. First thing to note is we have posted not just the contract, but also red lines for those of you who have been with us for several rounds now. The red lines relative to the prior procurement is available on the final materials page of the website. The structure of the contract follows what we have used up to this point in time in all the prior rounds. and the key provisions, and I will highlight them for you here, are going to be found in Article 2 of the contract that deals with product definition and facility requirements. We have Article 4 that deals with rack delivery obligations, what we are after in terms of how much you have to deliver through the term of this agreement. We'll talk about payment and invoicing as well as settlement under Article 5 and reporting requirements. There are some labor requirements, there are some production requirements that needs to be reported to the IPA. These are all found in Article 6 of the contract, and performance assurance, collateral requirements, they are all found in Article 7 of the contract. We have a couple of examples as well as forms for the credit instruments as exhibits in the contract as well. So, in terms of the basics of this transaction, take note that once you bid and you win and are communicated as a winner in the process, then the RECs from your project will be allocated to each of the utility companies as the buyer counterparty. You must be willing to sign an agreement with all three companies. You do not choose. You'll be signing three agreements for sure. And the contract will be administered separately with each of the applicable company, even though the terms are exactly the same. The quantity will be different, but the payment terms in terms of the strike price that you name will all be recorded in the transaction confirm or product order within the contracts. So once you are declared a winner, the bids from the quantity that you bid in your bid form as well as the strike price will then go into the product order. Strike price will be the same across the contracts. The index hub that you choose, whether it's PJM Northern Illinois Hub or the MISO Illinois Hub, once it's elected, will be part of the transaction confirm information. Then the annual quantities within each contract will be a little bit different. In this example, 100,000 is divided with the bulk going to ComEd, remainder going to Ameren Illinois and Mid-American Company, Energy Company. For this payment mechanism, as we mentioned a couple of times now, this is an index rack settlement contract. What we mean by that is that you will name a strike price. You can think of a strike price sort of as the levelized cost of electricity. So, how much you will take to develop the contract, install, and energize the project. And then, once it is energized to operate and to deliver the RECs for a 20-year term, you know what that cost will be. And between the energy markets, the wholesale energy markets, PJM or MISO, that you will get payments from for delivery of energy, and the utilities will pay for the RECs. We're going to make you whole at your strike price, more or less. It's not an exact science, but that's the concept of the index rack contract. So there are two terms that you should note in the contract that will sort of explain to you the settlement mechanism. So the first term is what we call the monthly price hourly component. So this is basically the difference between the strike price that you have and the index price, the real-time LMP from one of the two hubs, the MISO Illinois hub or the PJM NI hub, at each hour, as well as the megawatt generation output of the project in that particular hour. And here we are after the entire generation of the project, not just the portion of the RECs that are committed to the contracts or the IPA. So the REC monthly price hourly component, as a defined term, you should take a look at that, will sort of be used in the calculation of the REC monthly price So the monthly price is basically the sum of all these hourly components for a particular month divided by the actual generation for the project of the same month. So as you can see, this is really after a weighted average price, weighted by production in each hour. Settlement will occur on a monthly basis. If the monthly price is positive through this calculation, then seller pays buyer the invoice amount. If the monthly price is negative, then buyer pays seller the invoice amount. And for all payments, it's always going to be based on two components. One is the price component, the monthly price that we just talked about. And then there is a volumetric component, which is really just the racks that are delivered through the standing order. We're going to use the monthly price as calculated by the IPA, as discussed here, and then the racks as delivered in each month. So to try to fix ideas here, there's going to be a lag between electric generation as well as the rack issuance, and when payment will occur. So in terms of the timeline, taking July 2025 as the vintage month as an example, what we are requiring is after the month of electricity generation has occurred, within 5 business days of the close of July, that puts us into August 7, 2025, you will provide hourly generation data to the IPA and to the buyer counterparty. This is hourly generation that has occurred in July. And by the 20th day of that month, the IPA will issue a notice. This is a price calculation notice to both buyer and seller to confirm what the monthly rack price would be for the vintage of July 2025. Racks are not expected to be delivered for July vintage until the end of August. This is just how GETS and MRADs operate. There's going to be a 1 month lag. Usually, delivery occurs on the last business day of the month following month of generation. Your invoice is expected to be delivered to the buyer counterparty 10 days after that, by September 10th in this case, for you to issue your invoice. And settlement of the payments are due by the end of the month in which the invoices are timely submitted. So if you submit it by September 10, expect to get paid or paid by September 30th of 2025. In terms of the invoice calculation, again, we're not trying to settle or pay on an hourly basis. The calculations will be done for each hour for sure to get to the rack monthly price, which is a weighted average price for production in each hour of the month. But the price, once calculated by the IPA, will either be negative or positive. And if it's a negative price, that means that buyer will pay seller. And this is going to be based on the racks that are issued by GETS or MRADs and delivered to the buyer's account via the standing order. So this is just an example of what we expect to see in the monthly invoice by you, the seller, to the buyer counterparty. And this is required regardless of whether the price is negative or positive. And if the price is positive and you have to pay buyer, you can request that buyer issue you an invoice for documentary purposes. More on this can be found on Section 5.1 of the REC contract. In terms of the standing order is not established now, it's not established when you sign the contract, but it is established when your project is operational, once the date of first operation has occurred. Or if it's a retooled or modernized hydropower project, then after the hydropower refurbishment completion date has occurred. If it is already an energized project but is new under the law, then you can request the standing order be established soon after the procurement has concluded. Once established, the standing order, it cannot be modified. The standing order will be based on a few things, including the company's allocated share of the total amount that is awarded for your project, as well as a project committed percentage, which is the portion that you're committing your project to the utilities under this procurement. There is a space for you to allocate RECs or commit RECs to other third-party off-takers in the voluntary space. You don't need to commit 100% of your project to the utilities here. So once you're ready with those numbers and your project is energized and operational, you can send a notice to the IPA and the buyer utility counterparty to make known of that fact so that we can establish your standing order. RECs will not be settled unless the standing order is in place. In terms of the credit requirements under the contract, collateral requirement is due upon contract signing. It's due very shortly after. It is based on the annual quantity of RECs under the contract that is allocated to that contract. It is currently set at $4 per REC of the annual quantity, subject to a minimum of $20,000 for wind and hydro projects. And for solar projects, whether it's solar, utility scale, or brownfield, it is $10 of the annual quantity of RECs. We're going to grant unsecured credit based on the creditworthiness, basically the debt rating that your entity has with S&P, Moody's, or Fitch, the rating as rated by them. We are after a senior unsecured debt rating, and if it is investment grade, meaning BBB minus and above for S&P and Fitch, or Baa3 and above for Moody's, the collateral threshold is $2.5 million. Anything that is above the collateral requirement calculated above the collateral threshold, if you meet these requirements, will be met with liquid security in the form of cash or a letter of credit. If you're relying on a guarantor, you need an acceptable guarantee that is effective and acceptable to the buyer counterparty in place. You can find the forms of the guarantee as well as the letters of credit as exhibits to the REC contract. So, in terms of delivery requirements, I'll break this down for you. You can find more of this in section 2.4 of the REC contract, but basically, one REC. Just one REC must be delivered to each of your contracts by May 31st, 2029. If you cannot meet that date, then an increased collateral requirement, basically two times of the collateral requirement, will extend your deadline by 2 years to be May 31st of 2031. Subsequent extensions will be granted on a good cause basis upon request. And acceptance and grant by the IPA. And these all found in 2.4 of the REC contract. Delays outside of your control in finalizing the agreements or installing the interconnection facilities would be one of the good cause in obtaining necessary permits, approvals, or issuance of RECs from GETS or NRETS could be requested as a on a good cause basis to the IPA. But this must be after May 31st, 2031. Each extension will be for no more than a year at a time and must be through a written notice request to the IPA. So in terms of the dates that we are after, a few timing terminology, you'll find these things in the contract. What delivery term means, acceptable vintage period means. So when we say we have a 20-year contract for REC deliveries, we have allocated some time upfront for development of the project or the modernize and retool of your hydropower projects. But once those activities are concluded, then the way that the contract works is we will have a contract based on when the RECs are issued by GETS or MRETS to set what we call the acceptable vintage period. So if the RECs are issued by RECs, GETS or MRETS for the month of August as the first generating month, this becomes the earliest vintage month, 241 months after that, which is really 1 month after 20 years, will give you the latest vintage month. Any time between this period is what we call the acceptable vintage month for delivery of RECs. The delivery term itself will start when the first RECs are issued by GETS or MRETS, so that all three contracts will start at the same time, and the delivery of RECs will be within that delivery term, which will end 3 months after the latest vintage month. So in this case, if August 2024 is the earliest vintage month, the latest vintage month will be August 2044, and the delivery term will end November, which is 3 months after in 2044. So what are my obligations? Delivery obligations under the contract are denominated by what we call the delivery year requirement. This is basically a delivery obligations for each of the 20-year delivery years in the contract. It's going to be provided to you in the product order when your contract is executed. It will be the allocated amount in the contract of the RFP awarded annual quantity. It will be adjusted for degradation if your project is a solar, utility scale solar, or a brownfield PV project. And the degradation rate, this is a new item, will be indicated by you and collected as part of your part two proposal. This only applies to solar projects. You cannot name a degradation for wind or hydro projects. And the requirement, while we say the baseline is the delivery re requirement for each year, which we will calculate and provide to you in the product order upon contract execution, where it really triggers an event of default is if you fail to meet the delivery requirement for five or more times, and the sum of the shortfall exceeds the annual quantity, meaning 1 year's worth of quantity. If you miss that, and you miss some of these short delivery requirements resulting in a shortfall for 5 or more years, that becomes an event of default leading to contract termination, forfeiture of your collateral requirement. But we do afford some accommodations, such as an excuse of the shortfalls for the first full delivery years, as well as the stop period prior to the first full delivery year. So if you don't start on June 1st, then you will have a stop period. That stop period doesn't count in terms of delivery obligations, as and the first two full delivery years that runs from June of a year through May will not count against you as well. You'll still get paid, but you will just not count any shortfalls in those stop period and two full delivery years. Delivery requirements will be based on the REC vintage, not so much on when it is delivered, but when energy is generated, giving rise to those RECs, and is also going to be a number that we'll be looking out in terms of the maximum REC quantity that can be settled and paid for in a delivery year. You can find more information on Section 4.1 under the REC contract. Any RECs that are ineligible for payment, meaning outside the acceptable vintage period, or anything in excess of the delivery requirement, and any inadvertent transfers, they are all going to be yours to keep. They're not eligible for payment. You can use them for any purpose you see fit. They are not expected to be transferred via the standing order. If they are outside of the vintage period and not part of the project committed percentage. And if they are transferred to buyer's account, We have a mechanism for the return of these recs under Section 2.3F of the rec contract. In terms of the recs that are excess or outside of the project committed percentage, one more flexibility to bring down the shortfall amounts is that you may do a manual transfer. This is somewhat of an insurance so that you don't end up in an event of default situation or occurrence. If you can bring down shortfall amounts that occurred previously in prior years, if you have these excess recs that you are able to manually transfer. More information can be found in Section 2.3 and Section 4.1K of the REC contract. We have a couple of labor-related requirements. I'll name them here. One is the Prevailing Wage Act requirements. This applies to all projects, and this applies throughout the contract term. It doesn't have a stop or expiration date. If there are work done under the contract, you must meet the Prevailing Wage Act or PWA requirements under the contract. You, as an initial submission of documents, you provide to the IPA any verification or supporting documents that you have paid your employees the general prevailing rate of hourly wages under the PWA Act. This is due within 5 business days of the date of first operation or the hydropower refurbishment completion date or the effective date of the agreement, whichever comes later. And if you're a project that is in an adjacent state, meaning not in Illinois, your project will still be subject to prevailing wage requirements. And what we are after there is the federal Davis-Bacon rates to comply with the Illinois PWA requirements, if they are available, or the published prevailing wage, if available in those states. So I urge you to look at Section 6.2 as well as the definition of construction activities as these are found in the REC contract. So for project labor agreements, this is not new. What is new is for hydropower projects that are brought anew into this procurement, there are no requirements for project labor agreements for hydropower projects, to be very clear. For all other projects, this will be applicable for any construction activities that begin on or after September 15, 2021. For PLA or project labor agreements, this must be filed with the director of the Illinois Power Agency within the later of 30 days of when you sign the project labor agreement or the amendment or the effective date of this agreement or 60 days prior to the construction start, whichever is later. And there may be other procedures that are established by the IPA for the filing of these project labor agreements and amendments. So you shall work constructively with the agency to file these documents. You can find more information under Section 6.3 of the REC agreement. For the minimum equity standard, this is not applicable if the date of first operation or the hydropower refurbishment completion date has occurred prior to December 15, 2022. Again, the minimum equity standard is 10%. It is fixed throughout the contract term. It doesn't change year by year. It's 10%. And it is applicable only up through the date of first operation or the hydropower refurbishment completion date. So there is an expiration date when this is applicable. And 10% of MES means that 10% of your project workforce must consist of these equity eligible persons or contractor. So if you are on the hook for the 10% MES, we are looking for a forward-looking MES compliance plan due by June 1st of each year. The first plan is required of you within 30 days of bid approval, even if there are no construction activities that are performed on the project. There is going to be a mid-year MES confirmation due by December 31st each year, and then a report, a year-end report due by July 15 after the conclusion of a delivery where work is performed. If you are, meaning if you, the seller, the counterparty, are a equity eligible contractor, then you're deemed to have met the 10% MES. No other requirements are required of you for MES. But if you're not an eligible equity eligible contractor, then you must meet the MES under 6.4 of the contract. If you are not an EEC, if the seller is not a equity eligible contractor, but you have a subcontractor that is an EEC, then each equity eligible person in that subcontractor will be counted as 1.5 times towards meeting the MES. So the numerator are these equity eligible persons. The denominator is your project workforce. These are all defined terms under the contract: equity eligible contractor, equity eligible persons, project workforce, construction activities. We ask that you review these definitions as well as Section 6.4 to understand what the requirements are. So, Section 6.4 that deals with the minimum equity standard is separate and independent from the equity level that you may elect to be greater than 10%, greater than the minimum to qualify for any bid evaluation price adjustments. That is covered in Section 2.5 of the REC contract, which must be met and evaluated separately. There are some nuance there. We ask that you look at Section 2.5 of the REC contract for that information. And lastly, in terms of required reporting requirements, because we are settling the RECs on a hourly basis to come up with a monthly REC price, you will provide us after each generation month something that is required for each facility called the monthly generation report, covered in Section 6.1 of the REC contract. We're looking for the hourly real-time LMP and the hourly megawatt hour generation data at the generation bus or the project keynote. So this is what we will require of you. The real-time LMP we will get from PJM or MISO, and that is what will be used to calculate the monthly price. So that we can verify the information, we're asking also for read-only access to be granted to the buyer and the IPA for the projects, the PJM Power Market System or the MISO Market Portal for this purpose. If you're a modernized or retooled hydropower project, at time when you establish the standing order, you'll also provide the hydropower refurbishment completion date, the hydropower refurbishment start date as well, and also provide 4 full delivery years worth of data, megawatt hour generation data. These are hourly generation data prior to this hydropower refurbishment start date, so that we can calculate what we call the hydropower refurbishment threshold. You can find this term defined in the contract, but basically, we are taking the average of the two highest of the 4 years of delivery megawatt hour generation. And that forms the threshold that you have to meet in the first 3 years of the contract once your project is operational for settlement purposes. You can see more of this in Section 6.1 and 6.5 of the REC contract. So, with that, I will now turn this time over to Ms. Katie Olandi, which will walk us through the more practical aspects of the RFP and the contract execution process. Ms. Olandi?
Thanks, Ben. So I'm going to start off this next section with the schedule for the RFP process and the process to register for an account so that you can submit a proposal for your project And then I'm going to go through the details of the qualification requirements and process, like Ben said, and finish up with a final section on bid submission and the post-bid process. So the RFP process kicks off next week with the opening of the Part 1 window and then proceeds over the next couple of months. The qualification process is in two parts, and the first part is the Part 1 proposal when bidders submit their qualification materials. The Part 1 proposal materials are due on the Part 1 date, which is Monday, June 3rd. The bid participation fee of $500 is submitted as part of the Part 1 proposal and is therefore also due by this date. Applicants are given time to cure any deficiencies and respond to requests for additional information or clarifications from the procurement administrator. And then by June 17th, the Part 1 notification date, applicants are informed whether they've qualified to submit a Part 2 proposal. The Part 2 proposal includes posting bid assurance collateral with each of ComEd, AIC, and MEC in the form of either cash or a letter of credit. The Part 2 window opens on Tuesday, June 18th, and then closes on the Part 2 date, which is Tuesday, July 9th. Applicants that have a successful Part 2 proposal can then submit bids on the bid date, which is going to be held the following Thursday, July 18th. We'll hold a practice training on July 11th, 1 week before the bid date, and that'll give all qualified bidders a chance to ask questions for how to complete and submit the bid form and practice all submissions, all aspects of submitting the bid form through our portal, just like they would do on the bid date. Then bids are selected on the bid date. They're subject to approval by the Illinois Commerce Commission. The ICC is expected to release its decision on the results of the RFP on Wednesday, July 24th. So in order to submit a bid for a project in the RFP, a bidder must submit a proposal via an online proposal form. To register for an account to access the online proposal forms, you'll visit the procurement website, ipa-energyrfp.com, and fill out the qualification registration form under the Contact Us page. So you'll first select the indexed wind, solar, brownfield, and hydropower project category, and then you need to provide the number of projects for which you intend to submit a proposal. And that's because you're going to submit a separate proposal for each project, so you'll be provided access to multiple online proposal forms through a single account. You'll also be asked to provide your name, company name, email, and phone number for us to set up an account for you. Alternatively, you can submit an email to illinois-rfp@nera.com with the information that's requested on this slide, but please be sure to include the number of projects you plan to submit. So I would encourage everyone on this call that plans to participate to go ahead and request their accounts as soon as possible. A little more information, we'll issue one account per company, and the information to activate the account will be sent to the individual that registers for the account. It'll come in the form of an email from us from info@ipa-energyrfp.com, and there'll be detailed instructions for how to activate your account. There'll be a guide with screenshots for completing and submitting the online forms, and also instructions for paying the bid participation fee. And we'll begin issuing accounts next week, with the opening of the Part 1 window, and you will receive your account information within 24 hours of registering. Once you have an account, you can access the online forms to work on your proposal or proposals in two ways. You can go directly to the web address that's provided here, forms.ipa-energyrfp.com, or you can access this form site by clicking on the qualification form subpage within the indexed wind, solar, brownfield, and hydro section of the website. So in this next section, I'm going to walk through the details of the qualification requirements and process. This slide provides some general information before I start discussing specific requirements of the Part 1 proposal. So for purposes of your proposal, the bidder is the entity that submits the proposal, and the seller is the entity that will sign the index rec contract if the project is selected. And if there are multiple projects and sellers, then these entities are not required to be the same. And I'm going to provide some more information on naming the bidder and the seller on the next slide. The Part 1 proposal consists of information that's submitted through the online form, supporting documents that are uploaded to the online form, and inserts that are also uploaded. Supporting documents and inserts can also be emailed to us. Inserts are documents that we provide to you in Word format, and they need to be filled in and in some cases signed by an authorized individual. These inserts are posted to the website now, and they're grouped by category of project. So you can go ahead and download the appropriate zip file for your project at this time and begin working. So as I mentioned on the previous slide, the seller is the signatory to the index rec contract, and the bidder is the entity submitting the proposal. And this slide just provides some examples for naming those entities. If you're presenting a single project, the bidder and the seller must be the same entity. If you're presenting multiple projects with multiple sellers, we provide two examples here. First, you could use the parent entity as the name of the bidder, as shown in the bottom box, number 3. Or you could identify the bidder as the list of the seller name separated by a comma. So in box 2, the seller in the first proposal is seller C, and the seller in the second proposal is seller D. And then in both proposals, the bidder would be provided as seller C, comma, seller D. So once you begin filling in the online proposal form, you're going to be asked to provide a name of the project, and then to provide contact information for the relevant entities and authorized individuals that are applicable to the project. So for the seller and the bidder, you'll provide the exact legal name of the entity or entities and the address. You'll be required to name and provide contact information for an officer of the seller. This is the individual who will make all representations required in Part 1 and Part 2. And this individual must be empowered to undertake contracts and bind the seller. You'll also provide contact information for up to 4 representatives. The representatives are individuals authorized to act on behalf of the bidder and the seller. They're going to serve as our main points of contact and will receive all correspondence from us. Lastly, in section 1, if the seller is an equity eligible contractor, that's a business that is majority owned by equity eligible persons, a nonprofit or cooperative that is majority owned by equity eligible persons, or is a natural person that is an equity eligible person offering personal services as an independent contractor, then the bidder should indicate this, and then you'll be asked to provide the required documented evidence. In the Part 1 proposal, you're also going to provide, you're going to start off by providing some basic information for your project, including the category, so wind, solar, brownfield, or hydro. The project size is required in megawatt AC rating. A utility scale wind and utility scale solar project must be greater than 5 megawatts. There's no minimum size requirement for brownfield or hydropower projects. And please note that for modernized and retooled hydropower projects, you'll input the size of the hydropower facility upon completion of the modernized retooled activities. You must also provide the actual or expected date of first operation or the hydropower refurbishment completion if applicable. So in the Part 1 proposal, unless a project was operational prior to December 15, 2022, or the hydropower refurbishment completion date was prior to December 15, 2022, or the seller is an equity eligible contractor, besides for those cases, the officer of the seller is going to be required to acknowledge the minimum equity standard of 10% will apply to the project and that there are reporting requirements under the contract. Then in this section, on an optional basis, if construction activities for the project have not begun as of the submission of the Part 1 proposal, the seller may commit to an equity level percentage greater than 10%, And if you do so, you would qualify for the bid evaluation price reduction described in the rules. Now, in order to qualify, the bidder will be required to provide supporting documentation that's listed in the RFP rules and on this slide. Required information regarding the project site is going to differ across the categories. So this slide covers requirements only applicable to utility scale wind and solar. Applicants will provide the complete address for the project along with a map of the project site clearly showing the location of the project. A project that's located in a state adjacent to Illinois and wishes to qualify on the basis of the public interest criteria in the Act must be pre-approved by the IPA to be eligible for Illinois RPS compliance. Currently on the IPA's website, there's an evaluation spreadsheet to be completed and submitted to the IPA for approval. If you have a project that's located in an adjacent state, you can follow the link here on this slide to download the spreadsheet. You must use the one that's dated February 23rd, 2024, as it includes any changes stemming from the 2024 long-term plan. You'll complete all the required fields as instructed and email it to ipa.contactus@illinois.gov. And again, meeting the public interest criteria is only applicable to projects that are located in a state adjacent to Illinois. If you're located in Illinois, you do not need to complete this step. Applicants then confirm whether 50% of the project site is located within an energy transition community grant area. There's a list of eligible areas that are provided in Appendix 16 to the RFP rules. If it is, then the boundary of that energy transition community grant area must be provided on the project site map. Ultimately, this map is going to become an exhibit to a winning project's contract. This slide and the next three slides pertain to qualifying a brownfield project site. So a brownfield site photovoltaic project must be located in Illinois. Applicants must provide the complete address for the project along with a map of the project site. Now, importantly, the brownfield project must be entirely contained within the brownfield site. It may be co-located with another facility on a greenfield site, and if that's the case, then you'll disclose this fact as part of your proposal. So then the project that's contained within the brownfield site must have its own single dedicated meter and its own account registered with PJM Gas or MRET, and that project can be bid into the brownfield category. If it's co-located with greenfield, that greenfield could be independently metered and put through the RFP process in its own separate proposal under the utility scale solar category. So the project site also for brownfield must fit into one of two buckets from the definition under the Act. The project site's either regulated by the U.S. EPA or Illinois EPA under one of the four programs in the Act, and we'll list those on the next slide, or the project site is located at the site of a coal mine that has permanently ceased coal production, permanently halted any re-mining operations, is no longer accepting any coal combustion residues, and then meets the rest of the definition that's provided on this slide. So this slide provides the four programs under which brownfield site qualifying in the first bucket must be regulated. The table provides the applicable program on the left, and then a list of sufficient documentation that can be provided as evidence on the right. And the procurement administrator may consider other forms of documentation provided to demonstrate validation. But any document that's submitted must be dated no earlier 25 years prior to the bid date. There are additional requirements for projects regulated by the IEPA site remediation program. The additional requirements pertain to demonstrating actual blight or contamination at the project site, and they're discussed more fully in the RFP rules. For a project that's located at the site of a permanently closed coal mine, There will be certifications that must be made as part of the Part 1 proposal. And then to demonstrate that the project site meets the definition from the Act, the bidder must submit required permit documentation that's filed with the Department of Natural Resources listed on this slide. This slide now pertains to hydropower projects only. Applicants will provide the complete address for the project, the name of the existing dam, and a map of the project site that clearly shows the location of the project in the dam. Project that is located in a state adjacent to Illinois and qualifies on the basis of the public interest criteria in the Act will follow the same instructions as wind and solar and provide evidence that they've been pre-approved by the IPA. Applicants will confirm whether the project site is located within a hydropower preference community. This is a community that's either a designated environmental justice community or a community with median incomes that do not exceed 82% of the median income in the state of Illinois. And there's a list of eligible communities provided in Appendix 16 to the RFP rules. If it is located in a hydropower preference community, then the boundary of that community should be provided on the map. There are additional requirements for hydropower projects. The bidder must describe the existing facilities at the project site, provide a detailed description of the project, and describe the milestones that have been reached in project development. For a modernized or retooled project, you must describe the modernized or retooled activities that will take place at the existing facility. For a new hydropower project, the required supporting documentation includes an application with FERC for a preliminary permit or filed documentation for a license or exemption from licensing, as provided here in the first table. For a modernized or retooled hydropower project, a bidder must provide a filed application with FERC for a relicense, an application to amend a current license, or an application for an exemption from licensing. And this documentation must provide evidence that there will be an increase in the installed capacity of the existing facility due to the modernized and retooled activities. It must also reasonably demonstrate, along with the narrative description of the activities, that the project will meet the 30% hydropower refurbishment threshold under the contract. In regards to wind, solar, and brownfield, there is a project maturity requirement under the proposal. This does not apply to hydro. This requirement can be met by providing the documentation listed in the table from PJM, MISO, or utility, or it can be met by demonstrating site control for a portion of the project site. So if you can provide a document from this table, then you do not need to provide evidence of site control. And if you have not started the interconnection process, you can still qualify if you can show documented evidence of site control for a portion of the site. So if a project is interconnecting with PJM, the applicant may provide the QOASIS ID and a copy of the completed system impact study. If interconnecting with MISO, if the project is in the DPP 2020 cycle one or a later study cycle, you'll provide the project number and a copy of the preliminary system impact study under DPP one. If interconnecting with MISO in an earlier study cycle, then you'll be asked to provide the project number and a copy of the fully executed interconnection agreement. If interconnecting with a utility, then the fully executed interconnection agreement should be provided if available. If these documents are not available, or if a document that shows the project is farther along in the interconnection process is not available, then you're going to be asked to describe the stage of development of the project, and like I mentioned, demonstrate site control for a portion of the project site. So to figure out how much site control is required, you can use this slide. So you'll need to demonstrate site control for at least 40 acres times the project size for utility scale wind, at least 44 acres times the project size for utility scale solar, and at least 3 acres times the project size for a brownfield site photovoltaic project. The table on this slide here provides a list of accepted documentation to demonstrate site control. There's many different types of documents that we'll accept. You can provide different documents for different landowners. That's not a problem either. If you use a document that is a letter of intent or a memorandum of understanding that you've put together yourself for your business purposes, then it must satisfy specific minimum requirements. And these minimum requirements are posted as an appendix to the RFP rules. It's Appendix 4. There are requirements for some projects related to project labor agreements under the proposal. If construction activities for the project began prior to September 15, 2021, then this requirement does not apply to the project. This requirement also does not apply to hydropower projects. If construction activities have begun as of the submission of the Part 1 proposal, but did not begin prior to September 15, 2021, then the bidder provides evidence that the project labor agreements have been filed with the director of the IPA by email to ipa.pla@illinois.gov. If construction activities have not begun as of the submission of the Part 1, then the seller must certify that the project will be built by general contractors that have entered into a project labor agreement prior to construction. The seller will be required to make a number of certifications regarding the project and the seller itself, and this applies to all the different project types. So examples are that the project meets the requirements and the rules, the project has or will have a single meter, that there will be no substitution for another project. In regards to the seller, the officer will accept the terms of the contract and will also be asked to acknowledge the collateral requirements that are required to be posted if the contract is signed. The seller must also certify that the seller, including its contractors and subcontractors rendering services under the contract, will comply with the requirements of the Prevailing Wage Act. Oh, and notably, projects that are not located in Illinois must demonstrate at minimum wage parity with the prevailing wage requirements in Illinois. That'll be a required certification. So this slide continues with the requirements of sections 8 and 9 in the proposal. If the seller or its guarantor is rated by one or more of the major rating agencies, then all available credit ratings must be provided. It is not a requirement for the seller to be rated or to have a rated guarantor in order to participate. In section 9, the bidder will provide evidence of payment of the bid participation fee. This $500 fee is required of all bidders that have not paid the fee yet in 2024. If you plan to use a letter of credit to post financial guarantees under the contract, should you be a winner, then it's a good idea to begin working with your financial institution to get these documents in place in time. So you can download the two options for posting the post-bid letter of credit as provided in Exhibit to the Index Rec contract, and you'll submit red lines with any changes requested by your financial institution for review by the companies. This is entirely optional, but if you'd like to do that, you'll submit these red lines to us via the Part 1 form. There are preliminary lists of modifications that are already acceptable to each company that are posted to the website. If you submit a red line for review and then your requested modification is accepted by the company, then that modification will be added to the list and can be used by any bidder. A bidder can also provide comments on or propose modifications to the standard pre-bid letter of credit for each company. The pre-bid letter of credit is an option to be used to meet the bid assurance collateral requirement that's due with the Part 2 proposal. There's two versions of the standard pre-bid letter of credit, and they have different terms. There's the electronic version that accommodates transmission by the issuing bank by electronic means. And then there's a hard copy version that accommodates transmission by the issuing bank via overnight delivery service. So depending on your issuing bank, you're going to use one of these two versions. Again, there are preliminary lists of modifications that are acceptable to each company and posted to the website. The lists are grouped by electronic versus hard copy version. And same deal that if you submit a red line for review and it's deemed acceptable by a company, then that modification will be added to the list and any bidder can use it with their letter of credit. So once you've completed the form for a project and you're ready to submit to us for review, you're going to click submit on the online form, and then your proposal will be evaluated promptly. We will evaluate your proposal, and during that time, you'll be temporarily locked out of the account for that project. We'll provide a notice back to you as soon as the evaluation is complete, and it'll be either a complete notice or a deficiency notice. And if it's a deficiency notice, then we'll include a detailed list of items to clarify, or, you know, instructions on how to complete your proposal, and we'll provide you with the next deadline. Generally, bidders are given until the part one date or two business days, whichever is later, to respond to a first request for additional information. The part one date when your part one proposal must be submitted is June 3rd, and then the part one notification when you'll be informed whether you may submit a part two proposal is June 17th. The components of the part one notification are listed here on this slide. So should your project qualify via a successful part one proposal, you're going to get a letter notifying you of this fact, a customized bid form that you'll use for submitting bids, instructions for completing and submitting the bid form on the bid date, an invitation to a training session to practice bid submission, the confidential information that you need to log in and lock your bid form, and instructions for providing bid assurance collateral to the companies. So if your project's qualified, you'll begin submitting your part two proposal materials then the following day. And by the part two date on July 9th, you'll provide the first three bullets here on this slide. So you'll submit information through the online part one, part two form. You'll upload or email additional signed certifications, and you'll submit, importantly, your bid assurance collateral to each of the companies. So the bids are part of part two, but they're not due until the bid date on July 18th. So some of the requirements of the online form are listed here. You're going to elect whether you're using cash or a letter of credit to meet the bid assurance collateral requirement. You'll acknowledge the conditions under which bid assurance collateral can be drawn. You'll submit evidence, if applicable, you'll submit evidence the IPA has determined that any project labor agreement submitted for the project meets the requirements. And then you'll provide an indicative quantity for the project. The indicative quantity is an annual number of recs the applicant plans to bid, but is non-binding at the point of part two. So bid assurance collateral is a function of the size of the project. The amounts on a per megawatt basis applicable to each company are provided in the table here. So an example of how to calculate the bid assurance collateral for a wind project is also provided on this slide. So the bid assurance collateral required for a wind project that's a 200 megawatt size project for AIC would be 320,000. To ComEd would be 800,000, and for MEC would be 80,000. So that's using the table here and the project size. If you present a proposal for multiple projects, then you can submit a single cash wire or submit a single pre-bid letter of credit in the amount required for all of your projects. There are additional requirements related to bid assurance collateral provided here on this slide. If you're submitting cash, you'll provide a W-9 for the entity to which cash will be returned. You'll provide a draft request for the return of cash as well, and we post samples of that to our website. And you'll also provide a signed cash insert to acknowledge the conditions under which cash can be drawn. If you're submitting a pre-bid letter of credit, for a company, your bank, again, will use either the electronic version or the hard copy version. If you're using the hard copy version, it's highly recommended that you ask the bank to also submit a PDF version by email along with a tracking number so that the companies can track your package. A pre-bid letter of credit for a company must be in the standard form provided as one of these appendices or incorporate only modifications acceptable to that company and specifically acceptable either to the electronic version or the hard copy version. We will send you detailed instructions for submission of bid assurance collateral with the Part 1 notification. So there'll be a lot of information provided. And lastly, I just wanted to note that if you do use cash for bid assurance collateral, then that cash can stay in place to meet any required performance assurance requirement under the contract should you have a winning bid. So that concludes the overview of the qualification process. And then this final section is going to provide the protocols for submission of bids and the steps of the post-bid process. Just a few slides left. So a customized bid form that we provide to each bidder is the exclusive method for submitting bids. Bid forms are submitted through a secure bid transfer site on the bid date, which is July 18th, in a bid window, which is 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. noon central. If the bid form is not completely filled out or if it's inconsistent with the rules, then it won't be evaluated on the bid date. So once the bid window closes, there's a cure deficiency period of an hour, and we ask bidders to be available during this cure period so that if there's an issue, we can get in contact and remedy the issues before the cure period closes. We'll provide a step-by-step guide to bidders with a qualified project as part of the Part 1 notification. And then again, bidders have the opportunity to practice their bid submission procedures in a training session. There's also a backup method for submission of your bids, and that's by email if you should experience technical issues with the online site on the bid date. Your bid's going to have three core elements. You provide a strike price for the project in dollar per megawatt hour. You provide a full quantity, and that represents the annual quantity of RECs that the seller is offering to deliver. And you also provide a minimum quantity, and that represents the minimum amount of the minimum annual quantity of RECs that the seller is willing to accept as a partial award. So a project could receive a partial award, so less than the full quantity, but never below this minimum quantity. And it's only in the case that the project is the marginal project selected during bid evaluation, meaning that it's the project that, if selected, would mean exceeding the target for the category. So for example, in the table on this slide, in the dark purple cells, the hypothetical 100 megawatt wind project is bidding to deliver an annual quantity of 300,000 RECs. The bidder is inputted here a minimum quantity that's less than the full quantity. So the bidder is indicating that it would accept a partial award of no less than 250,000 RECs at the strike price of $100. So this means if it's not possible to select at least 250,000 RECs, then the project would not be selected. Very importantly, in the bid form, the bidder will also select the index hub, either MISO Illinois hub or PJM Northern Illinois hub, that corresponds to the bid for the project. And this hub, of course, is used for payment purposes under the contract for the project. On the bid date, we expect to notify bidders by 6 p.m. whether the project has a bid that's identified as a winning bid to the commission or earlier if possible. At that time, if a bidder has not already provided the information to prepare the contract with the proposal, then that information must be submitted to us by email. Then within 2 business days of the bid date, the procurement administrator and the procurement monitor will submit a confidential report to the ICC, and within 2 business days of receipt of those reports, the commission will decide whether to accept or reject the results. Once the commission renders its decision, each company will send partially executed contract documents to the seller. The seller then countersigns and sends back the contract documents electronically and fulfills the creditworthiness requirements. And we'll send detailed instructions regarding the execution procedures to bidders that have qualified projects. The collateral requirement under the index rec contract is due within 8 business days of approval of the results, and payment of the supplier fees to the IPA is due within 7 business days of approval. And so that completes the presentation portion of the presentation.